But it's because they love you and they're trying to help you to learn to be right and to be good. Because that's all that the Lord really requires of us. When we walk after Yeshua, is to be right and to be good. All right, off to your classes. This is our 17th sermon in the book of Hebrews, 17th week that we've spent studying the book of Hebrews. And God willing, we're coming to an end here. I think next week will be the last week in the book of Hebrews. But this week we are in Hebrews chapter 12. Last week we went through Hebrews chapter 11, the great hall of fame of faith, the faith chapter, where it begins, now faith is being sure of what we hope for, certain of what we do not see. And so we learned regarding faith that faith is founded upon these two premises, surety and certainty. And then the writer of the book of Hebrews illustrated these two ideas of surety and certainty from the lives of the faithful. And we learned from that we can have faith, we can have surety and certainty by recollecting, by learning, by meditating upon the lives of the faithful and how God rewards the faithful and how the faithful throughout history, throughout the biblical story, throughout history, have pursued God despite their circumstances. And so we learn that faith is not blind. We often hear of blind faith or stepping out in blind faith. But blind faith is, that's like an oxymoron, because faith is surety and certainty. Blind faith implies that you don't know what you're believing in. You're just kind of taking a leap because you're not sure, you're not certain. But true faith, biblical faith, knows what it believes in. You're confident in what you believe in. We also spoke of how this is not childlike faith, though. We speak of childlike faith, a faith of innocence, a faith of humility is perhaps what we should understand as childlike faith. But it's not faith of ignorance. Because sometimes we think of childlike faith as like, oh, that's just, you don't question. Like children don't question. That's not the point. That's not a real faith, a faith that doesn't question. That's an unexamined life, an unexamined faith. Our faith isn't afraid of questioning. We're not afraid of questions because our faith is founded on surety and certainty. And when you're sure and when you're certain, you don't need to be afraid. You don't need to be defensive. You can be confident. I often notice that people become the most agitated in conversation and argument when they're the least certain about what they're speaking of. So you often hear speakers, this was a friend of mine, a lawyer, pointed this out to me, and this is something that he had learned in law school just by observing his colleagues, and then he began to realize it was true in the pulpits as well, that the more agitated and angry the speaker became, the less certain he was, or the less confident he was in what he was presenting. Yeah, could be. I'm going to remain very calm through this sermon. We also, last week, learned from the lives of the heroes of our faith that faith is not always realized in this current world, this present world. We don't always see the fulfillment of what it is we are believing and what it is we are seeking. Remember, he took us through that whole list of the heroes of faith, and then he summed it up in verse 39. He said, these were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised. Wow. All these people who spent their lives living and believing, walking and faithing, living out their faith, a life of obedience based upon that faith. None of them received what it was they were believing in. Well, there's an encouraging thought. But he says, follow the example of the faithful. This means we might not always see the rewards of our faith, not in this life. Think of the thousands that were marched into the ovens saying, Shema Yisrael, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Is this what faith gets you? This is much the same situation that the writer of the book of Hebrews was facing, that his readers were facing, was coming persecution. They could read the writing on the wall. They'd already been kicked out of the temple. There was the heavy hand of persecution was raising up again. And so he's encouraging them to stand firm in their faith. We will endure suffering. We will endure hardship. We will endure persecution. It's part of the walk of faith. And so he's telling them this. He's writing to encourage them. And they're in need of such encouragement. He says, remember, you're not the first to walk on this road. There are others who have gone before you. Others who have done this before. Others who have suffered before you. And so he goes on to make a parable in this week's material. We begin in chapter 12. And he's going to make a parable. He's going to make a comparison. Remember, I told you that way when we begin the book of Hebrews that this is a Pauline writer. Probably not Paul himself, but it's someone from Paul's little clique. It's someone from Paul's school. He's writing from Rome. He's a friend of Timothy and so on. So he uses a lot of Pauline language. Now, when Paul would speak of faith, unlike the sages of his day and our day, and even the writer of Proverbs and so on, when these people would speak of faith or compare faith to in a parable, faith is always the life of faith is compared to a walk. It's how you walk out your life. It's the path you're on. Right? We read this in Proverbs all the time. So you get the word halakha, the application of your faith. How you live out your faith is your halakha. This metaphor doesn't work for Paul. Paul's life wasn't really a walk. For him, faith was not a walk. You may or may not enjoy reading Paul's epistles, but you must agree with this regarding Paul, that his life was a phenomenal run. He was a man of absolutely boundless energy who just never stopped. He's constantly on the go. For him, life was not a walk. It was a run. It was a race. And so he invokes this race metaphor several times. One example we read in the book of Corinthians, Paul writing to the Corinthians, he says, I do all this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. That's faith. Faith in what's been promised. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like a man running aimlessly. I do not fight like a man beating the air. No, I beat my body and make it my slave so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. For Paul, the walk of faith can be compared to an athlete running in a foot race or an athlete training to run in a foot race. This athletic metaphor comes right out of Greek Hellenist society, where the games, of course, you know, the Olympics come from this Hellenist world, and each major Greek city had its own gymnasium where you could go and compete in all these races and games and so on. And the sages were not keen on this sort of thing, on competitive sports and such, because they came with the Greek, all the trappings of pagan Greek culture. And yet Paul seems to be very fluent in speaking here of the races and what goes on in the races. You remember, he's from a Hellenist city originally. He grew up in Tarsus. Jerusalem had its own gymnasium. And Paul's generation, they were into athletics, I think. Because Paul's colleague, It would have been his colleague while he was a student under Rabbi Gamliel. And his colleague, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, Simon the son of Gamliel. We read about him in the Talmud that when he would prostrate himself in the temple, he would do it on his fingertips. He would do push-ups on his fingertips. And he was famous for his athletic stunts. This is the Nasi of the Sanhedrin. He becomes the head of the Sanhedrin. But he's famous. He's known as this athletic master who all the sages just shake their heads. And say, no one can do what he does. This is Paul's colleague. So I think there might have been some attraction to the Hellenist world of athletics. You know, I myself was never involved in athletics because I have a serious impairment of you know, the sun is always in my eyes or something like this. But this is to my disadvantage. We learn a lot from athletics. The athlete learns something that I wish I had learned, and that is, it is self-discipline. It is, I would call it the art of delayed gratification. Delayed gratification is that you set aside what would immediately gratify you in order to reach a goal. You're working for a goal. Paul says you're running for a prize. We live in a society that is based upon instant gratification. You know, everything is geared to satisfy you immediately. And so we grow up and we raise our families and so on with the idea that you should be able to get what you want as soon as you want it. And, you know, credit cards make this possible and so on. So you don't even have to have the money to buy the things you want or whatever. We don't learn self-discipline. It's not something that's taught. And yet it is taught within athletics. Hebrews chapter 12 is where we find this metaphor. He says, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses. The great cloud of witnesses is, you have to imagine, all the men and women that we just read about in Hebrews chapter 11, like spectators in the stands of the gymnasium. They're watching the race. Scrutinizing the race? I don't think that's the point. Instead, imagine them cheering you on like this, go, 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 because they've already run it. Now, this immediately for me begs the question, like, well, how does this really work? Are they really watching? Or, you know, it's like Abraham up there watching, you know, what you do and how it is. Like, oh, I can't believe it. You know, what? I don't know. That's not the point. You know, I mean, imagine, like, you're trying to, like, well, I better not do that because I don't, you know, I'm embarrassed that Abraham and these saints and so on are watching. It's like, God is watching. God is watching. There's that. You want to be embarrassed? There is an eye that sees. There is an ear that hears. And all your deeds are written in a book. God is watching. Forget the great cloud of witnesses. The great cloud of witnesses, you are to regard them as your support. They're cheering you on. He says, therefore, since we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. So I have, okay, let's work with this metaphor here. Let's parse this out. What is the race marked out for us? What has been marked out? What has been delineated for us? It is righteousness. We are running the race of faith that results in righteousness and holiness. So what is this code of righteousness? Where will we find a code of righteousness? Where will we find the markings that mark out the path that we run on? It is the Torah. Torah is the racetrack because it is God's standard of right and wrong. Sin is violation of the Torah. And it is something that hinders us. Anything that keeps us from running the race at full speed from the life of righteousness. it says throw off anything that hinders. It might not just be sin, but it might be a friendship. It might be a relationship. It might be a job. Could it be a job, a career, my sustenance, my provision from God? At one time in my life, my wife and I came into a conviction of the Shabbat. It meant a total career change because we were involved in a career that based its income on Saturdays. Saturday was the money day. And so for us, you know, we were looking for some guidance, and Stan, you know, was involved in this, and I, you know, said, so, you know, what do you think I should do? And he said, I've never seen God not bless someone who has set aside their job or whatever it is in order to honor the Shabbat. But it's up to you. Well, God blessed us for certain, but it took years and years and years to financially catch back up. And sometimes you don't always see it in this lifetime. You know, I want you to ask right now as we're reading this, you know, to be asking, what is it that so easily hinders? What is it that entangles? What is the weight that is keeping me from running this race full speed? You know, is it, ask yourself this, gentlemen, is it the modem in your computer? Is it internet access? What is it that keeps you from running the race? The sin that entangles, that besets us. The sin, the way that it says it in the Greek, that surrounds us. You can't get through, you can't run, because there's every time you try to make the distance, there's sin and it's surrounding you and it's pushing you off of the track. It's pushing you off of the path, the course that has been marked out for you, the straight, the narrow, the Torah. Here's what you do, verse 2. He says, let us fix our eyes on Yeshua, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne. Now, when it says the author and perfecter of our faith, I've always kind of you know, accepted that author of our faith as like an author who writes a book. But the word in Greek is not author, it's archagos, which means the front runner. He's leading the pack. He's the runner who broke out of the pack and is in front. So he's, keep your eye on the guy who's running in front. The Nachshon, the breach maker. The author and perfecter. I would translate it this way if I was translating the book of Hebrews. The front runner and the finisher. He's the guy who finishes the race of faith. He's the guy who goes over the finish line first. And so we follow him. He's the winner. And when he wins, we all win. So we imitate him, we follow him, we run after him. Fix our eyes on Yeshua, the front runner and the finisher of the race of faith. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men. The writer of the book of Hebrews, again, is speaking to a group of people who are facing opposition from the same sinful men, the Sadducean priesthood. So that you will not grow weary and lose heart. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. Whereas, blood was shed for you. So we are to run after him who ran for, I love the way he puts this, who ran for the joy set before him. His motivation, his zeal, that which kept him going in our midst, when the Master was walking among his disciples, what was it that pushed him on? Joy. He ran for joy. He served for joy. He went to the cross for this motive. Joy. That's delayed gratification. To go through the cross on the route to joy. If we are to run like Yeshua, to be, what's the word? Christian. To be a follower of Messiah. We must run for joy. But to run well, a racer requires training and self-discipline. The writer of Hebrews goes on to speak of another type of discipline, parental discipline, like I was speaking to the children with. This is in verse 5. And you have forgotten that word of encouragement that addressed you as sons. Because it says in the Proverbs, it says, "My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline. Do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves and he punishes everyone he accepts as a son." So he says, endure hardship as discipline. This is a principle he gives us to live by. Endure hardship as if it was discipline, even if it's not. You don't know. Why do bad things happen to good people, right? The simple answer, the honest answer is, who knows? God knows. God is the one who's weighing things in the balance and settling accounts, and we don't see the final picture until we come to the world to come. And yet, for practical purposes, the way that we conduct ourselves in this life, since we know that He works everything out for good, we are to endure personal hardship as if it was God's discipline, even if it's not. God is treating you as sons. For what son is not disciplined by his father? This means we interpret, when we face trials, when we face difficulties, any kind of tribulation, we are to interpret it as discipline. Not in a self-loathing sense of like, oh, I'm so wicked, I deserve it, you know, just do bad things to me. And not in a punitive sense, like, God's really getting me for my sins, because you know that's not the way He operates. Rather, discipline in the character-forming sense of when you discipline your children, you know, those of you who are parents, you realize this, that there are two senses in which you discipline your children. There's there is the loving sense in which you want to bring correction. You're going to teach them not to do that particular behavior again. There is a negative reinforcement for that behavior, whatever that mode of discipline is. And then you bring positive reinforcement for good behavior because you are steering and directing their character. And then there's the punitive, which is simply because you are a mean person. You are a mean mom and dad. And those kids make you mad. Don't be like that. You don't want to be like that. But you sometimes are. And your parents sometimes were. And you remember that. That was not fair. It happened 40 years ago, but it's still not fair. God's not like that. When God disciplines you, it is not in the punitive sense. He is disciplining you for character formation, to make you into the kind of son or daughter that brings honor to Him. Now, the advantage to thinking of life like this, that when you face sickness or trouble or distress or whatever it is, the advantage to thinking of it in terms of discipline, as the writer of the book of Hebrews is telling us we should do, is this. It offers a redemptive perspective on hardship and trouble. Life has hardship and trouble regardless of how you think of it. So what will you do with it? Make something useful out of it. Use it to curb and correct your own character. That's what he's saying. That's what he's suggesting. And so by doing this, why do bad things happen to me? You could have several answers. Because it's not fair, life is not fair, God is not fair. Or, because God is teaching me. Because God is shaping me. Because God is correcting me. It's the more positive way to deal with life. And in that, we can come through it, though not, maybe not, your, this isn't your experience through hardship the whole time, but you can come through hardship taking joy in God's direction in your life because He is treating you as a son, as a daughter. If you are not disciplined, verse 8, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are illegitimate children and not true sons. If a father or a mother does not discipline their children, you have to wonder if they love that child. Maybe they're just very foolish. But the reality is that children who grow up undisciplined. I once, you know, was teaching an Awana class, of little 6-year-olds, six, seven-year-olds. And I asked these children, these beautiful little children sitting out in this church, I asked them, kids, do you know where bad people come from? And they had all sorts of theories like the pirates, they're the descendants of pirates and that sort of thing. But then I dropped the bomb on them. I said, no, you know where bad people come from? From bad children. Bad children grow up to be bad people. It's true. So if you love your child, you don't want them to grow up to be a rasha, a wicked person, and you discipline them. And so he says, if you are not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are illegitimate children and not true sons. Moreover, we have all had human fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of our spirits and live? There's a problem here, though. Not all of us have had human fathers that disciplined us, and not all of us have had human fathers that disciplined us, and we respected them for it. There are cases where you have just, you know, you didn't respect them for it. Maybe you deserved it, but oftentimes there's also cases where they did not deserve the respect, whether you gave it to them or not, because they were not disciplining you, they were abusive. And the problem then is that we take that idea of our father, the abusive father, and project that onto God. And imagine him to be the same kind of capricious and abusive father, only now in an eternal sense. So we need to be very careful about projecting our own recollections and our own psychological baggage regarding our parents onto God. It says, our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best. And maybe they were wrong. As they thought best. They're human beings. They're fallible. Just like you. They make mistakes. As a father or a mother, you make mistakes. You know it. And you would be horrified to think that your children someday will form their image of God based upon their image of you. But it's true. We need to avoid abuse in any form. The Talmud says, discipline with your left hand and embrace with your right. That is, unless you're left-handed, then invert that. Our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best, but God disciplines us for good, for our good, that we may share in His holiness. See, our fathers might have disciplined us capriciously, unjustly. But God, when He disciplines, it is always for our good and for a purpose. It's purposeful. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. So I think this is a very useful life principle we're learning here, that when you face trouble, hardship, whatever it is, sickness, say you got a cold, okay, you got a cold, here's what to do. Here's what you do with the cold. Rather than commiserate about it and just think about, it's not fair, I got to do something, you think, how can I use this cold to improve my character? To shape myself. But you know what? There's a danger, because you can become very judgmental of others if you apply this to others instead of yourselves. Like, oh, bad things are happening to them. I wonder what they did. God's really getting them. Did you hear that? So-and-so got a cold. I wonder, what sin did they commit? And you want to also avoid the trap of being superstitious and paranoid. Like, I caught a cold. I caught a cold. What sin did I commit? And this introspective spiral down, wretched man that I am. We use it for a positive end. God is always positive in dealing with His children. Even when it's harsh, it's for a redemptive purpose, not for condemnation. There is, therefore, no condemnation for those in Messiah. Verse 12, therefore strengthen your feeble arms and weak knees. And we're back to the race metaphor. Strengthen your feeble arms and weak knees. Get back in the race. Make level paths for your feet so that the lame may not be disabled. I think this should be understood so that, the twisted ankle, you got the twisted ankle, you're out of the race. Get back in the race. Get back to training so that you rather be healed. Train yourself. Be healed so that you can run this race again. And it requires discipline. It sometimes means hardship. It sometimes means trial. Maybe sometimes you feel like, well, this doesn't, what I'm going through right now does not feel very healing. But the redemptive perspective is that we share in the suffering of Messiah, who took our punishment, and therefore we can interpret our suffering as correction in a positive respect. And in that regard, it can only work good in us. It is the opposite of, God doesn't care what I do. I can get away with anything because I'm under grace. Everything's okay. Everything's permissible for me. Rather, God does care. If He didn't care, He wouldn't love you. So we're still speaking of the faith as a race. And He goes on to list several vital, important pieces of the race. He says, make every effort to live in peace with all men and to be holy. Without holiness, no one will see the Lord. This is this call to holiness. Where do we find it? What does that mean? What does holiness mean? We'll find that defined for us only in the Torah. Leviticus chapter 19 begins the laws of holiness. But there's some equilibrium here. It says, live in peace with all men and be holy. It's possible to be holy and not live in peace with all men. So you need to bring some balance here. To be separate from the world, but at peace with the world. Verse 15, see to it that no one misses the grace of God and that no bitter root grows up to cause trouble and defile many. What is a bitter root? I think we understand. Bitterness is unforgiveness. And so what's the remedy for bitterness? Intentional forgiveness. To be intentionally forgiving. How do you do that? It's more than just, okay, I forgive you. But it's done through, we live in a physical world. It requires physical action, acts of kindness. Verse 16, see that no one is sexually immoral or godless like Esau, who for a single meal sold his inheritance rights as oldest son. Afterward, as you know, when he wanted to inherit his blessing, he was rejected. He could bring about no change of mind, though he sought the blessing with tears. Actions do have consequences. We are to learn here. It's one thing to say, I am saved by grace, but you must realize that your actions still have consequences, some of them to be unloaded upon us in this life, some of them to be unloaded upon us in the world to come. And so for Esau, It was too late. He had lost the opportunity. Why? Because he could not delay his gratification, but he needed the soup, like right now. Let me tell you why this race is important. Why it's a big deal that you keep your eyes on Yeshua, throw off the sin that entangles, and accept discipline from God, and live holy lives, and at peace with the others, avoiding bitterness and immorality. It's important because of this, because you haven't arrived at Mount Sinai. You've arrived at Mount Zion. Remember, we looked at this at the beginning of the book. Kol Vahomer, from the light to the heavy. It's a rabbinic method. It's an argument. For example, Yeshua says, if the master of the house was called Beelzebub, how much more so then will the servants? So you disciples, if they're calling me evil, how much more so will they call you, my disciples, evil? It's a rhetorical device. How much more then? And that's how the rest of the chapter goes. He says, you have not come to a mountain that can be touched and is burning with fire, darkness, gloom, and storm. And usually we read this, say, see, you're not under the law. Lucky you. You have come to Mount Zion. You're under grace. But there's not antithesis here. We don't have a contrast here. It's a statement of how much more than. And it works like this. If you thought Mount Sinai was serious, where every impeachment of the Torah received its just punishment, if you thought that was a big deal, there was lightning, and if you touched the mountain, you'd die, how much more than now that you have come to Mount Zion? Because that was for this world. What we are talking about is the world to come. That was the reflection. We're talking about the reality. God was speaking from earth, he says. You can read it in this chapter. He says, his voice was speaking on earth. How much more so when he speaks to us from Shemayim, from heaven? So he says, verse 22, you have come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the assembly of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. Reference to the book of life. You have come to God, the judge of all men, to the spirits of righteous men made perfect, to Yeshua, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. So, see to it that you do not refuse him who speaks. If they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, how much less will we if we turn away from the one who warns us from heaven? So if the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai, where God spoke in an audible voice from earth, demanded our obedience, how much more so when God speaks from heaven? Because at that time his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised, once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. The words once more indicate the removing of what can be shaken, this world, that has created things, so that what cannot be shaken remains. Therefore, he says, therefore referring to everything he just said, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, eternal life, let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and fear. For our God is a consuming fire. Aaron, if you could come up.